Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I always think that is way too promissory to say that our discussion of the economy is ever going to be exciting.
I think it's more of a promontory sort of thing.
Yeah, promontory.
It's a promontory rather than a promissory statement. I didn't say it's going to be exciting. I just said
another exciting.
To another exciting. It is exciting.
Now, to some people.
Yes, me.
We're trying to figure out what to say in here.
Right. It's very trying.
Yes.
We're very trying to figure out what to say. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we have, astonishingly enough, entered the mid-20th century with telephone equipment.
Yes. Our technology in here is cutting edge.
1950s.
I would say that the telephone system is cutting-edge 1990s technology.
Really? You think so?
Oh, yeah. It's got lights and buttons.
Right. It's got some digital stuff in there. Pre-Star Trek, though.
Yeah.
Because the button doesn't light up. There's a light next to the button that lights up when you press the button.
Right. Yeah.
So that was one of the major changes in...
But it doesn't have a rotary on it. It doesn't have a little bell in it. So it's not 1950s technology.
I guess electronic. Maybe 60s or 70s or something.
I would say 90s. I really would.
I think there are
probably digital boards in there that...
So you think it's only about 20 years behind the power curve?
Yeah.
As opposed to the...
25 or so.
This thing right here, which I know
it's the control
was
board.
Not new in the mid-1960s.
Because right.
I saw this thing in the mid-1960s, and it was already dirty, and it's dirty in the same spots.
Yes. This control board is, we do have a turntable in the control board.
Right. But it's actually over here underneath this table.
Yes, it is. Right. You just lift this thing up. It's all connected in. If we needed to play records in here, we could do it.
We could play 45 records in a heartbeat in here. And I did that, back before the hills got dusty. Well, we have a telephone caller on 773-1400, and you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, a couple weeks ago, you mentioned that Barron said that oil was going to go to $75 a gallon. Or
a gallon, probably, yeah.
It's a gallon.
I was wondering what that's based on, and if it does go to that, will that affect fracking? And I'm going to listen on the air.
Ah, well, yeah, that's interesting.
Fracking will affect that
rather than
the other way around.
Yeah, it goes both ways. And by the way, the price of oil has continued to drop. Basically, what we're saying is there's this thing called supply and demand.
Wait a minute. I don't believe in that stuff.
And believe it or not, across the world, you have a reducing demand for petroleum. And a lot of people think, how can they? It's demand per capita.
Yeah. Demand per capita in the United States is about half of what it was in the 1980s.
And at the same time, we have found ways in this United States of America to get a lot more oil out of places where we didn't think we could get it. You combine those two and you have people. What happens is, will it affect fracking? The fracking will eventually catch up and pass the cost of oil to the point where a lot of capital is being sunk into fracking. And believe me, companies will continue to pump the oil out of the ground at reduced prices to try to recover their capital investments in putting the holes in the ground long after it makes any sense. Because it just doesn't make any sense as long as you can keep pumping it out for less than it costs to actually pump it.
Right.
And we're going to get there. We're on the way in a big hurry. There's two big forces going on in the world. There's a third one out there,
too. There's actually probably more than that I can think of right now.
But this issue of use less fuel combined with there's more fuel to use, $75 is probably a conservative on the downside. If we got a recession at some point, it'd probably drop below $75 a barrel. What does that mean? That means that probably the price of the gas pump won't go up a whole lot and will go down some in the not too distant future. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Basically, he wanted to know some of the reasoning. So let's give some of the forces behind this. First off, I don't think the price of oil is going to go down based on the current technology in wind or in solar panels.
Right.
Those prices
I hate to break this to you, but wind and solar panels do not produce oil.
Correct.
Just wanted to let you know that.
Yes.
Okay.
But when you look at the cost of energy being produced, that does have an impact on oil prices. Mm-hmm. It has a very indirect impact because oil is being used less and less in the production of electricity. Let me think, just think about that for a second. Why is it that we used to use oil to produce electricity and we don't now? Let's think about that. There's got to be a reason
for
that.
Price of oil went up?
Oh, wait a minute. Wait, the price of oil went up, so we're using less of it. This is why oil prices are... We've talked about this, actually, for about a decade. Mm-hmm. When oil prices are sustained at a very high price for a long period of time, people find other methods of doing what the oil does. So.
Yes.
We've used batteries, we've used other forms of electricity generation so that...
Chipmunks.
We've got coal, we've got little chipmunks running around in wheels inside of cars.
Right.
Right. And when I say I don't think that solar panels and wind is going to have an impact on
but
the price...
But chipmunks might.
Chipmunks might.
Right.
The reason is because solar power and wind isn't experiencing a great... boost in efficiency because there's too much government money in it making it profitable to do things that shouldn't be profitable. It is not profitable if you take all the subsidies away to have solar panels produce power. It is not profitable if you take the subsidies away unless it's in very specific circumstances for wind power to be profitable.
Right.
Fracking does have an impact here. Fracking is producing gas, and a byproduct of that is some other petroleum products. But
it's
really,
more gas than it is oil.
Yeah, really the price of oil is coming down because our cars are getting more efficient.
Mm.
And when I said per capita costs, per capita oil use in the United States is about half of what it was in 1982, we're talking about 32 years.
Right.
The reason why it's half, I used to have a 1982 pickup truck, and I had it not too long ago. It got 8 miles to the gallon, and it was considered to be normal.
There's another factor that's a big player, and we talk about supply demand, very simple supply demand, okay? But there's another factor in there that's caused the price of oil to go up historically, and that is that there are countries where people used to ride bicycles and they now drive cars.
Correct.
Which is the prime examples would be India and China.
Correct.
They are learning something exactly the way we learned it, and that is initially they had a laissez-faire libertarian attitude of who cares about pollution? The world, it'll take care of itself. It's somebody else's problem.
Doesn't work very well. That's the plight of the commons.
Which is a fascinating thing for a communist country to have, but they're not communists. They're relentless capitalists right now.
Right. They just call themselves
communists.
They're
just state capitalism.
State capitalism.
And what they have discovered is that on several occasions, it has cost them many hundreds of billions of dollars specifically because of pollution in water. And they have had, it's very, very clear to anyone.
Well, the water is not clear. It's just clear when you're looking at the unclear water.
So they are cracking down and trying to make water more clean because they recognize it's very expensive to have dirty water.
It's kind of what we did in the 1970s.
And apparently, from all the reports I get in Beijing, which is where the capital is, which is downwind of the major industrial areas, the air is so thick with pollution that sometimes you can't see 3 or 4 feet, and the number of people who are having respiratory problems as a result is going up, particularly elderly people.
And there's being more and more elderly there.
And if you'll notice, the people who run that country are elderly people. London had these famous poisonous fogs.
The black fogs of London.
And people were dying, and all of a sudden the government in England decided that maybe cleaning up the air was a good idea.
Right.
In the United States, we got a little ahead of the power curve, and we looked at the numbers and realized that the health care costs and the lost productivity costs of having a lot of people with emphysema who weren't smoking were really hurting our economy, and so we began to insist that the air be cleaned up. Well, China is awakening to the fact that they need to clean the air up, increase fuel efficiency, do all this kind of stuff, and they're following, by the way, exactly the same pattern we did in England.
They're doing it faster, though.
Everything generally has had.
We followed London, only we did it faster. They're following us, only they're doing it faster.
And as a result, you're going to see increased fuel efficiency requirements become quite universal over the next couple of decades. And
it's already happening.
Right.
I mean, part of it is market-driven.
Right.
And that during the recession, people had a lot less to pay for gas, which is part of the reason why General Motors and Ford had problems, because they thought Americans will always like to drive tanks to work.
Otherwise known as SUVs.
Right.
And really big pickups. In Texas, we still do.
Yeah, they were completely right until they were completely wrong, which is one of the great truisms of history. That's the way most of us are. We go about being completely right, making exactly the same decision, and then suddenly that's the wrong decision. So when we look at the future of oil, there is no doubt in my mind that we're going to leave oil behind. It's just a question of when. And when oil becomes too expensive to continue to use it, somebody will create another concept of how to create energy. And let me go back to the reason why we use gasoline to begin with. We use gasoline because Henry Ford was trying to figure out something to power his internal combustion engine. And the one use that was really marketable in the petroleum world was for oil was kerosene. And one of the junk byproducts of kerosene in the production process, in the refining process, was this thing called gasoline. What were you going to do with all this gasoline? People were dumping it in the fields. They were literally just pouring it out because they didn't have a use for it.
The Chinese still do that.
Yeah, the Chinese still do that. They were going, what do we do with this? I don't know. So Henry Ford says, I'm trying to make a very inexpensive product, and I want to use stuff that's left over from other things, because we're coming through a time period with some pretty tough financial issues. So I want to use something that's really inexpensive. So he used gasoline. Well, the next version of power generation for transportation, somebody's going to do the same thing. They're going to say, well, this isn't being used by anything at all. It's really cheap, and we can replace gasoline with it, whatever that might be. Until that gets too expensive for a long enough period and somebody goes, well, let's use something else. And that's just the way we work. So it isn't a question of if we stop using oil. It's a question of when. When it becomes too expensive to continue to use it, we will stop using it. And when it has been hovering around $110 or $115 a barrel for a significant period of time, it's amazing. People have stopped driving SUVs so much. They've stopped driving trucks when they don't need the trucks. The cars that are being used are smaller and more efficient in the United States. People thought that would never happen. It's happened. It's just a matter of expense.
By the way, if you want to have something to worry about, and we really need something to worry about.
Could you have something I can worry about at the moment?
Yes, I can give you something to worry about. I want you to worry about porcine. Porkine? Porkine. It's of the pig.
Of the pig.
Yes. Epidemic diarrhea virus.
Oh, wow.
You should worry about that.
Dude. Ooh, yes. Is it a pandemic, epidemic?
What kind of epidemic is it? Well, it's an epidemic virus, and it is affecting pigs.
Oh, my.
In 28 states now.
That doesn't sound fun.
It isn't, and it's killing the young pigs.
Which is causing bacon prices,
which is
to go up.
If you are just looking at the producer price index, which is, by the way, up 1.4% year to year, which is not enough.
Right. We still need more inflation.
We need a little more inflation. But the biggest riser, the biggest thing going up in there is pork. And the reason it's going up is because there's a lot of pigs dying. And if you want to see something that's absolutely classic economics, if you're interested in that type of thing, go to the supermarket and notice that the price of, a national average at least, the price of pork products is up about 20% from this point last year. And you can say that's inflation, and people generally, this is why we talk about the volatility of food and fuel. On the other hand, chicken is down. The price of chicken is down, but the price of pork is up. And that's because chicken, by the way, is a very fast cycle. We did have some chicken shortages in the winter.
All we had to do is have more chickens.
But actually, well, yeah, and the issue is some chickens froze to death in the southeast because there weren't enough Hispanic people to drive the trucks to deliver the fuel to the hen houses.
Right.
And so this is the kind of thing I find absolutely fascinating. I saw the price of pork was going up and says, something's happening here because pork is normally cheaper than beef. And all of a sudden, I went to the supermarket and noticed that the price of pork per pound was higher than the price of beef per pound. And beef is up because of the drought.
Right.
And so started looking around. This is one of those things where in Iowa, a virus shows up. And in Texas, in the supermarket, in a relatively short period of time, the price of pork jumps upward.
And by a relatively short period of time, we're talking about a day.
Right. And it, and as a result, this is you want to see economics in play. This is it. Now, what happens then, people will, this would be an interesting, somebody's going to get a PhD out of this. They're going to note that people stop buying pork and start buying more chicken, which means that the price of chicken will then rise.
Right. So these market cycles are built around exactly what we were just talking about with oil. When the price of one thing gets too high, we find its replacement that is cheaper. And eventually, and sometimes if there's only two things, then they go through this cycle back and forth and back and forth until another thing comes into the picture and mm-hmm. both of those other two things go away.
And here's one of those things that a lot of people don't really get that I find absolutely fascinating. And that is, we talk about that thing on Wall Street in New York. It is the New York Stock Exchange. We call it the stock market. Folks, there's another one in Fort Worth.
Yep.
That actually handles more volume. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, by weight.
By weight.
Definitely by weight. It is a stock market. It is just livestock market.
And it is a stock market. And the price of stock goes up and down on both markets. And people say, you might say, well, it's an interesting coincidence. They're both named the same thing. No, they are the same thing.
Exactly the same thing.
And the origin of the stock market as we know it, meaning shares in individual companies, goes back to the buying and selling of stocks on an auction market, which is exactly what happens here in Bell County on a regular basis.
Fair, the value at the market fair was
the
fair
market
value.
Right. And so the issue is, you really want to understand the stock market and how it works, go to the livestock shows around here.
Right. It's exactly the same stuff. It's the same auction.
They just talk
louder and faster
they smell very much the same.
Yes, they
do. I don't know if they talk louder or faster because my experience with what goes on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange is there's just a lot more people talking louder and faster.
See, in the New York Stock Exchange, it became, for a long time, it was louder on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. It got louder and harder to understand. Now it's a lot quieter.
Really?
There's a lot of tapping on keyboards.
Well, yeah, but there's still a certain amount of paper that gets waved around and
right.
people
running
about here and there. And actually, it's the futures exchange.
That's the one
up
with
in
all
Chicago,
the paper.
Where there's a lot of they get down in the pits and they yell and
but
scream.
But the futures exchange is talking about the futures of the livestock market than it is about the futures.
Well, I think it's really fascinating that we're buying and selling the future.
It's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah,
I like a little piece of the future, please.
But there's a little bit of bigger picture here that I wanted to touch on before we wandered off into some other subject. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number is 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
This is one of those days when you have a tremendous amount of stuff to talk about, a lot of detailed, fascinating stuff to me economically that was absolutely out of the world. But this is the big picture. International Monetary Fund just came out with a report on the world, the state of the world, basically. They come out with this once a year, and it's a detailed accounting. And the International Monetary Fund basically is very, very, very international. And when you read the names of the people who are making the announcements and so on, you realize that they aren't exactly from the Midwest in the United States. They are basically saying that the major systemic threats that we faced are being dealt with adequately, and that the United States economy is A, robust. I love that term. They don't use that term very often. B, quite healthy and C, likely to do extremely well into the foreseeable future. Now, this is from a bunch of folks who have no great love for the United States of America, probably, and since their names sounded very European to me. And yet they look over at the United States and say, you guys apparently pretty much got it right. Now, at the same time, the European Central Bank and the European community in general is saying, yeah, we're probably going to have to start entering quantitative easing. This was a fascinating thing. And start negative interest on deposits at the European Central Bank.
That's,
in other words, charging people to have their money there.
Right. That's a little bit scary.
Well, we did that a little bit here. The issue is that deflation is a distinct threat. The year-over-year inflation in Europe right now in the Eurozone is 0.05%. It's about 1.4% in the United States. Theirs has been falling. There's a lot of concern. And the euro has risen in value dramatically, which is hurting their exports. Why? Because probably an awful lot of people are converting rubles into euros. The United States, by the way, slammed some exchange restrictions on Russia, but the Europeans didn't. And as a result, there's a lot of people converting rubles into euros, and the price of the euro is rising. There's another big thing going on in the world, and I know this sounds... This is one of those things that's worth keeping an eye on, though. This is one of those big issues that's been there a long time. For the first time in 14 years, year over year, there is a net sale of foreign holdings of Japanese treasury securities. Whoopee-doo, you say. Okay,
yeah.
Well,
this is something we said we were going to talk about last hour. Japanese treasury securities being sold
right.
by foreign investors, or in our case, domestic investors
right.
in their foreign market.
But they're just basically people who foreign investors have been parking money in Japan for the last 20 years. Do they get any interest on it? No, they get zero interest. But what they get is the phenomenal stability of the Japanese society.
The rent payments for
right.
for their tax payments, basically.
And as a result, their people were perfectly satisfied to get no return on a currency that stayed locked in place against everybody else. It was safe. Well, the Japanese have decided that austerity, as they practiced it for many years, wasn't working all that well.
They were locked in place for 30 years, which is why people were there.
15 right? years in a recession, they decided was long enough to try this experiment. So they have started doing deficit spending, but above all, they were doing that earlier. Above all, their central bank is using quantitative easing all of a sudden, lowering it. Well, they can't lower interest rates. Interest rates were at zero, so they started using quantitative easing and buying their own bonds. And the end result is their economy is starting to pick up. People are starting to get hired, and they're beginning to get just a little bit of inflation in there. The yen has dropped against the dollar a little bit.
What's more, people are able to actually, to some extent, still not anywhere near as easily as here, but they're beginning to be able to get mortgages to buy new houses.
Yes.
Something that has not happened in Japan for many years. You basically had to buy with cash if you were going to buy a house. Which meant, and now they still require 50% down payment a lot of times, but that sure is a lot easier to get if you're buying a house than 100% down payment.
There's a coincidence here. For 14 years, Japan has been stuck in neutral.
Uh-huh.
With money pouring in, buying their securities. So they now, by the way, the governmental debt in Japan is about 200% of gross domestic product.
Right.
Here in the United States, the new mortgage issuance is the lowest in 14 years.
Right.
And what's happening is people who are buying houses, this sounded all familiar,
yeah.
are having to buy them with cash. And banks are hesitant to loan people money to buy houses.
The banking freeze issue is the greatest threat to our economic well-being. If we don't continue to put more liquidity into the bank that they are willing to give out as loans and actually take some risks with, we won't be able to move forward. Moving forward is a risk. Not taking too much risk is very important, but taking some risk is just as important.
Taking no short-term risk is a guaranteed way to long-term disaster. And what we're seeing in the United States right now, there's a lot of things going on that are worrisome. Hopefully, though, we're going to see some loosening up in the not-too-far-distant future.
Loosening up in the knot?
You got it.
Yes.
But above all, this is something that we need to get used to. We, from World War II forward, a lot of the fast growth in the United States economy was based on ever easier ability to buy houses for people who could afford them. And ultimately, we slipped past that.
And said, it's easy to buy a house if you can't afford it.
Right.
Whoops,
and
that's
now
a problem.
Now we've gone back to the ultra-conservative side. In other words, it's time to liberalize a little bit, loosen things up a little bit, and allow people to go back to buying houses. And eventually, I think we're going to get there because we have a pretty good system for that. Right now, everybody's running scared, so they won't do it. People are paying off mortgages rather than buying houses,
yeah,
this which is by the way, very irrational at
right.
this point.
Paying off debt is never all rational. Paying off debt is a very emotional thing, and it's an emotional thing that is very important to a lot of people because the American dream really is about owning your home. It's not about having a bank own your home that you pay them for every month.
It isn't?
No. If for some reason, people actually do want to own the home themselves at some point. The emotion behind doing it faster doesn't have to do with profitability. It doesn't have to do with this is the best use of money. Mm-hmm. It has to do with
securing oneself.
Right. I want to be in a place where I own my home. And if you consider that a lot of people's mortgages right now are running at 3% or 4%. That's the interest rate on their mortgages, and people are paying it off quickly. Where when the interest rate on mortgages was 17 or 18% in the 70s and 80s,
people didn't pay them off.
People were like, I don't want to pay off my mortgage. I'm just, you know, I've got to keep cash on hand. Think about that for just a second. That is the way we as investors tend to work. We tend to do the wrong thing with the money if we're trying to be rational. Emotion comes into it, and we have to take it with everything else. We have to say, this is the way we will feel better. Pay off the house. We're going to feel better. But please recognize while you're doing it that you may be doing it too fast. We get a lot of people in. I just spoke with somebody yesterday that was paying off their house really quickly, and I didn't tell them not to. In fact, I think it's good for them to do it. However, it isn't rational. So recognizing that some of the things that we do are not rational, and we mentioned this book last hour, Predictably Irrational. It is true. Some of the things that we do aren't based in logic or ration. We have to accept that.
Instead, what we use is rationalization, which is the opposite.
Correct. And that's the point. That's the danger. If you're rationalizing irrational things, then you are lying to yourself. You should just say, this is a priority, and I'm willing to pay extra for this priority. That's important.
Just to give you some insight of what we just said, and then we got to do commercials.
And then we're going to talk about Illinois and Puerto Rico because we said we would.
Right now, the market is low, relatively speaking, historically. A person who puts money into the broad stock market, which represents the economy of the United States today, if you put it in correctly and you leave it there for the next, let's say, 15 years, there's certainly no guarantees. But I would say, on average, based on history, you would have at least four times the money that you invested today 15 years from now. On the other hand, so that's basically what we're saying is that fundamentally around a 7% rate of return. And that's on the low side of historic returns in the stock market. On the other hand, if a person...
Wait a minute. How many hands do we have here?
A lot.
There's a lot of other hands. On the other hand, there are fingers.
If they take... You take a mortgage at the current mortgage interest rates today, presuming that we continue to have, and I think we will have, a mortgage interest deduction for people with a reasonable income. The bottom line to it is it costs nothing to have a mortgage because inflation will probably, over the next 15 years, be about the same as your net mortgage interest rate. So basically, paying off a house early is put you in the position where you don't have anything better to do with the money, so you'll put it in at a zero return because you'll feel better about that, versus roughly quadrupling your money over the next 15 years.
That's the cost that it is for the security.
So
some people are willing to pay that cost.
Yes, but it's really important to recognize what you're doing and recognize that once the money goes into the house, you can't get it back out.
Not easily, anyway.
Well, in many cases, you can't at all. For instance, let's just say somebody paid off their house around here. We hit a economic really bad rough spot, and the government is short on tax money, and they shut down Fort Hood. Do you really think you can get your money back out of the house at that point?
Not completely.
We ain't going to get much back out of that house at all. So it's just one of those things to think about as you move forward. Look at the long term. Think about the real risks that are out there, and there are risks out there, and where the best place is to have money, have your invested money, to help offset that potentiality. And we got a break for commercials. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be back on the other side with more of whatever it is we've been talking about.
Attention.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're going to be talking about Illinois, Puerto Rico, and municipal bonds and the harbinger for Social Security.
Yes.
And we got about 15 minutes to do it.
You can say harbinger. I will say bellwether. How's that?
Hegemon.
That works too.
Okay. A bellwether is a neutered ram
that carries a bell
and leads everyone.
Yes. A harbinger is one that foretells doom.
Hmm. Harbinge. Right. Yes. Okay. Now, anyway, let's talk about municipal bonds and pension funds and how that is likely to affect Social Security.
Yes. Let's do that. You want to start?
Well, for those of you who haven't noticed, there are underfunded pension funds scattered here and there, and probably the...
Wait a minute. For those of us that have noticed, it's there as well.
Okay. Well, if you have noticed or haven't noticed, it doesn't make any difference.
Yes.
Illinois, for example, has pension funds. Chicago is probably the prime example. Has pension funds funded about 28% of what is necessary to pay the pensions, and yet there are laws in the state of Illinois that says those pensions have to be paid. So
28% funded, they need to get up to 100%, and the law says they got to pay it, but that just because the law says it doesn't mean that the money's there to do it.
And there's a lot of municipal bonds being sold by Illinois and Illinois municipalities backed by the state of Illinois, given high ratings that are paying higher interest rates than Treasury securities and will allow you, for example, not to pay federal income taxes on the income under most circumstances.
Right. So this kind of fits in nicely. I can point at, I was going to talk about Puerto Rico. You're talking about Illinois. Well, just a few years back, Puerto Rico was paying a very high percentage comparable to other municipalities on its municipal loans.
What bonds? These are municipal bonds.
Right.
Like bonds, you buy on the open market.
Yes. You're in essence giving a loan
to Puerto Rico.
To Puerto Rico.
Right.
Or to Illinois to Chicago.
If you buy a Chicago bond, in essence, if it's a full faith and credit bond, theoretically, the state of Illinois is backing, and I say theoretically, it backs it until the legislature says they don't.
Yeah. And what happened with Puerto Rico is that it was the same characteristics as what's going on today in Illinois. You had supposedly the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the territory of Puerto Rico, was going to back with its tax revenues the municipal loans or bonds of each of those entities that were selling them. And just a few years back, people were coming to me and saying, you know, I was pricing around CDs and I was pricing around municipal bonds, and it's consistent. It's so consistent. These CDs and municipal bonds over in Puerto Rico are paying a higher interest rate. I would really like to go and do that. And CDs, even FDIC-insured CDs that were at Puerto Rico, and people were saying, I want to put $500,000 in, this is a better place. And I said, well, FDIC doesn't cover $500,000. At that point, it was covering $100,000. Now it's up to 250,000. Anytime a bank or a municipality or anyone else for that matter offers to pay you more for the same sort of product that somebody is paying you less for, the interest rate here is what we're talking about. They do it because there is a risk involved. They really, really need the money. Otherwise, they wouldn't pay extra money to get it. And this is the same reason why a few years back we were saying these AAA rated mortgage-backed securities that were paying 8% didn't make any sense, because the words AAA don't, that category does not go with an interest rate that's higher than other AAA stuff. In the case of municipalities, if the interest rate is high, it's probably because there's a lot, not probably, it's because there's more risk. They're not going, it'd be like, and this is an easiest example in the world that I can give. If you have $300,000 in a bank account, you have a portfolio in stocks and bonds of somewhere around $1 million, you've got, you own your house outright, and a bank says, I will give you a loan, and you decide you will use the loan. You say, I will buy a car with this loan. And the bank says, I want to charge you 16%. You're going to say, no, I'm going to buy it with cash. So the bank says, oh, well, let me lower that interest rate. Let me charge you 10%. Nope, I'm buying it with cash. The bank has to come way down because you're not a risk. You can use your own money. You can use other people's money at a lower interest rate.
Basically, banks will loan you money when you don't need it.
Right. Is it raining? No. Well, here, have an umbrella. That's the way the bankers are thinking. So it's very easy for somebody with a lot of money in the bank to get a 0.9% loan on their car. If the bank is trying to get the loan, or the municipality is trying to get the loan, a bank gets a loan with a CD, it is doing the same thing you are. If it has a lot of money sitting on hand, it is not going to pay a lot of money in interest, just like you're not going to pay a lot of interest on that car if you've got a lot of money on hand. If a municipality is paying a high interest rate, it's because they don't think that they have everything together to pay it back. And so that's my whole statement on why interest rates are as high as they are in what happened in Puerto Rico. So I'm going to hand it back to you for more on Illinois.
Well, there's a couple of things that are kind of coming out here. One, what they're doing in Chicago, and it's going to be subject to lawsuits, so they might not ultimately wind up doing it, but this is what the legislature finally agreed. Initially, the idea was, okay, we'll raise taxes. We'll raise property taxes across the state. We will cut the standard, we'll cut the cost of living out of pensions for the city, for employees, and we'll make them pay more money in, and over the next, you're going to think this is crazy, over the next 40 years, we'll get well.
Oh, well, that's a nice little business plan you've got going there.
Well, guess what? The property tax thing, so they're not going to raise taxes.
They're not?
No. But no. They are going to do is reduce the measure by which they are increasing the cost of living.
Okay.
And require employees to contribute more to their own plans. Now, here's the problem with that. Any rational person taking a look at that would conclude they're going to blow up. It won't work.
It's not going to work. If they were going to save it in 40 years by doing all of that and more,
right, and
then
not
doing
as
all
much
of that is not going to save it in 40 years. It probably is going to fail.
When asked about the same issue facing Social Security, what the managers of the Social Security system, the board, actually answered, they gave a very clear answer. We're good to 2033, and at that point, we can fund indefinitely at 75% of current benefits. Now, that's an interesting way of looking at it, and I realize this sounds all very strange.
So basically, the retirees of these pension plans are going to get 75%
of what they expected to. No, we're talking about Social Security.
That's what I'm saying, these pension plans.
Well, what we're saying is that the Social Security Administration came out with their board of trustees, and they said, unless something is changed in the system quickly, In 2033, we're going to have to cut 25% from everybody's Social Security, and then we can fund it. It'll work.
Now, 2033 is only 17 mm-hmm. or 18 years away,
and
19
this is,
years.
And if you look at the, by the way, this is something I'm seeing. Remember I've told you about the 14 years and this thing? I am seeing a lot of numbers come together on these forecasts, just like I saw back in the 1970s when the Army went to Volar in the early, mid-1970s,
Volunteer Army,
when they raised the pay scales to make the Army competitive with outside employment, but they cut retirements. Well, the Army brass and the Association of the United States Army and a lot of veterans and everybody got together and says, no, you can't cut retirements. You have to bump them back up because otherwise we can't recruit. So they did bump them back up, betting on a smaller Army, which, by the way, we haven't had because we've had wars. And now the retirees warned that sometime around 2030, if you didn't change the system, it would bankrupt itself. Well, we're headed there with military retirements now. It's right on the horizon. There's no question it's coming at us, and it's got to get fixed. These guys actually make some pretty good forecasts. They just make them so far out that nobody worries about them.
Yeah, people go 40 years out. We don't have to worry about that. Or 20 years out. We don't have to worry about that. 5 years out. Mm-hmm. Forget about it. Next year, well, then they start getting a little bit worried.
Sometime around 2030, which isn't that far away, folks, is about 15 years, we're going to have another financial crisis in the United States. And the little pieces of it are popping up almost everywhere we look. The issues are around pension funds, annuities, things that promise a stream of income in the future are underfunded. And they're betting on a better something happening miraculously in the future, which is unlikely to occur. We're in a slow growth economy. We're probably going to be in a slow growth economy. Technological innovation does that. The reality is we've got a steady, slow growth and a crisis in about 15 years. This is why I say paying your house off, paying your mortgage off could be really scary. I know that sounds crazy. If you have money invested someplace that's likely to hold some degree of value and have some degree of liquidity, and we get into a real bind at some point in the future, and your Social Security and or military retirement gets cut 25%, if you don't have a liquid source of income to go to, you could find yourself in a real pain. And people say, oh, yeah, well, I want to pay my house off because that way at least I'll own my house. No, you won't if they raise property taxes and you can't pay the property taxes. And if you need to move, this is one of those points where just this is one of the things to file away in the back of your head. We have about 15 years, 10 years for sure, of probably the best economy most of us have seen in our lifetimes. On the other side, there'll be another crisis. And when you make decisions today, how well you will do in that crisis will be dependent upon the decisions you make today. That's what financial planning is all about.
Being
enough of
prepared,
my rambling.
Being yeah. prepared is, you know, we talk about being ready for critical financial events. Because there's individual critical financial events. There's a retirement. That's your financial event. There's paying for college. That's your financial event. Being aware and flexible for critical financial events that aren't about you, that are about the whole economy. If you're not prepared for that, then you're not prepared.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty simple statement.
I like your logic.
Well, essence, I have a firm grasp on reality.
I'm glad. Well, that's exactly what people pay us for, you know. And I want to throw one other little thing in. It's probably going to upset a few people, but that's okay. It's reality. There have now been three places around the United States where the minimum wage was raised to $10.10. In none of the three, this is fascinating, did hiring collapse. As a matter of fact, hiring seems to have picked up after a little bit very nicely. Why? Some economists took a look at this. San Jose, California, they had basically a voter-pushed referendum that caused San Jose to force a minimum wage on all employers of $10.10 an hour. Yeah, there was basically a hiring freeze for about 60 days prior to it going into effect. Once it went into effect, the people were hired that would have been hired. There was suddenly a hiring push. fast food hamburger flippers now making $10.10 an hour. Jake said a while ago, whoa, whoa, they're going to be in trouble because their profit margins are so slim. As it turned out, by raising everybody's minimum wage to $10.10 an hour in San Jose, California, you had low-income people making more money and, as a result, buying more hamburgers. So the fast food joints actually increased their profitability by raising their minimum wage.
Yeah, the places that it's going to be more difficult are things are places where they're manufacturing or doing something that the money is coming from outside of the area where the minimum wage is.
If we did it nationally, though.
Right. If it's across the board, it would cause more jobs to be sent overseas. It would happen.
Maybe. Although we're bringing them back.
We would also bring others back. It's just a question of how much and when.
The Congressional Budget Office said it would put about... It would pull about 900,000 people out of poverty, which would reduce the cost of the government by a whole bunch.
Right. And, it would actually move some money around in the economy.
All right. Well,
it may not be all bad, but...
And you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach talk about all kinds of silly things. And if you'd like to give us a call and talk to our voicemail, which is breathlessly waiting for you right now, 947-1111. Otherwise,
you can reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read about us. You can contact us through there. You can listen to more of our blatherings on our podcasts. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.